fallout from the targeted killing of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani. Iran is vowing retaliation, and President Trump warns that he'll strike 52 of Iran's cultural sites, an action that many say would be a war crime.
We see loss that can't be replaced. That is, loss of our history, loss of the things that make us who we are.
Also, this member of Iraq's parliament supports U.S. troops in Iraq, but he's at his wit's end.
We do not understand the United States these days.
Also, Ricky Gervais brings a cringeworthy international twist, with laughs, to last night's Golden Globes. His message for the winners? Don't lecture the rest of us.
You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Today, they mourned in Tehran. Massive crowds of people flooded the streets of the Iranian capital for the funeral of General Qasem Soleimani. He was killed last Friday in a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad, in Iraq. It was ordered by President Trump. The reverberations from Soleimani's killing could potentially be enormous for the Middle East, the United States, and the world. Iran now says it's pulling back from the 2015 nuclear agreement. In Iraq, the government is taking steps toward demanding that American troops leave the country. We're going to start our coverage today with the world's Shirin Jafari. Shirin, tell us more about what you've been seeing from Tehran today.
Like you said, Marco, the crowd in Tehran was huge today, from what I've seen on social media as well as the Iranian state media. Some people have compared the number of people out on the street today to the size of crowd that we saw back in 1989 when the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, passed away. And today, people were chanting slogans, they were carrying pictures of Qasem Soleimani, and a lot of them said they wanted answers from the U.S.
So today, the general's remains were paraded through Tehran. What do we know about what happens next?
Today, his body was taken to Tehran University, where the supreme leader prayed over the coffin. And the footage from the funeral shows the supreme leader weeping. And what happens next is that Soleimani's remains will be taken to the city of Qom. That's a holy city about 2 hours' drive from Tehran. And tomorrow, his coffin will be taken to his hometown of Kerman, and that's where he will be laid to rest.
What have you been hearing about why the U.S. carried out this attack?
Well, we have heard several explanations so far. One, which was announced pretty quickly on Friday, was that the U.S. officials had credible intelligence that Qasem Soleimani was planning attacks against American diplomats and armed forces in Iraq and other countries in the region, and that this drone attack was about self-defense.
Are they still offering some kind of information or explanation, though?
The explanation shifted. And it turned into, well, Qasem Soleimani was a bad actor in the region, and that over the years, he had ordered or planned many attacks against the U.S. and its partners. So far, there are various explanations.
And what has Iran been saying about its response?
In Iran, one word has been repeated in the past few days, and that's revenge. Iranian officials have said that Iran plans to respond for sure, and maybe even militarily, but they haven't given any more details. Today, at the funeral procession in Tehran, Qasem Soleimani's daughter gave a fiery speech, and she said her father's blood was not spilled in vain.
America and Sahyonis bedanand shahadat pedaram.
Marco, she also said that her father's killing will bring Iran and Iraq closer together.
And what about Iran's government? How have they responded?
The Iranian government says it will no longer comply with some of the terms of the nuclear deal that it signed with world powers in 2015. President Trump walked away from the deal last year. But to be clear, Iran is still going to let inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency to come in and inspect its nuclear facilities, because it continues to be a member of the NPT.
Right, Iran's still in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So talk of revenge in Tehran, and the U.S. is sending more troops, it sounds like.
Yes, the U.S. is sending about 2,500 Marines to the Middle East. The Pentagon won't say when or where these forces are going to be deployed. At the same time, the U.S. says it will pause its operations against the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. That's out of caution for the safety of American personnel. NATO has also said it will suspend its mission against ISIS. Here's what Jens Stoltenberg, NATO's Secretary General, said today.
The safety of our personnel is paramount. As such, we have, for the time being, suspended our training on the ground. And we are taking all precautions necessary to protect our people.
So both the U.S. and NATO have now paused their operations against ISIS, and it's not clear how long that will last.
The world, Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for the update.
No problem, Marco.
Next door, in Iraq, tensions are also rising in the aftermath of Soleimani's assassination. Several rockets landed in Baghdad last night, one in the green zone near the U.S. embassy. Those missiles were likely launched by Iraqi militia groups who revered Soleimani. That's according to Hamid Reza Azizi. He teaches international relations at Shahid Beheshti University in Iran. And those Iraqi militia, Azizi says, may have bigger plans for retaliation.
I think we should expect a kind of twofold revenge to come. One that Iran is talking about, it will come in a kind of calculated and not necessarily quick manner. But the things that we are witnessing now in Iraq in terms of, for example, recent rocket attacks and these things, this is the second aspect of the revenge, which is coming from those groups which consider Soleimani as their own commander.
There's now been a vote in Iraq's parliament to expel U.S. troops. It's non-binding. Still, President Trump responded with threats for Iraq, sanctions, and a hefty bill, billions of dollars to repay the U.S. if it has to withdraw its troops. Sarkat Shams is a member of Iraq's parliament. I reached out to him in the city of Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan. I asked Shams if he cast a ballot to pull out U.S. troops.
No, I didn't participate. I boycotted. I rejected the whole bill and the whole motion of taking steps toward destroying the relationship with the United States. So that's something that we do not want that, and we want to have a peaceful relationship with both the United States and Iran.
Mr. Shams, I mean, you're in the Iraqi parliament. How seriously is the parliament taking Trump's threats of sanctions and this giant bill for U.S. troops that have served in Iraq that he's talking about?
Publicly threatening Iraq while you are considering Iraq as a partner, while you have your soldiers in Iraq fighting ISIS alongside Iraqi soldiers, and you do not find a diplomatic channel or at least calling the Iraqi prime minister to better understand the bill and the steps that the Iraqi government is going to take. Just on Twitter, threatening Iraq is going to be even worse for the relationship, and it will damage the relationship even further.
Well, U.S. troops are still in Iraq. The prospect, though, of U.S. troops leaving, are you worried about your country breaking down further into Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish enclaves?
Absolutely. This is the fear that we are trying to avoid, and this is the consequences of a forceful expulsion of the U.S. forces. If it is peaceful, if it's based on the mutual understanding, based on a request, and then we negotiate their presence again through diplomatic channels and by talking to our leaders, to the White House, this is something else. But this the way that it's been handled, and it looks like the militias that continue to threaten the U.S. embassy and the other embassies and the green zone that we have, most of the foreign embassies there have been bombed every night. Like last night, we had rockets targeted at the U.S. embassy. This is going to really make Iraq a war zone, another Syria, and will really give rise to radical groups to exploit the situation.
So with Presidents Bush and Obama, there was a kind of consistency to their policies, even if some say those policies were misguided. Does Donald Trump confuse the Iraqi parliament?
Exactly. We do not understand the United States these days. It's very hard to understand the United States. We hear something from their diplomats. They deal with Iraqi institutions with respect. Even some of these militia leaders, they had some meetings with the U.S. diplomats. But disrespecting Iraq and ignoring Iraq by the U.S. president and Iraqi leaders, not having them in the White House so far, not inviting them to the White House, and just seeing Iraq through the lenses of the enmity with Iran is really something that we do not see, that the U.S. is seeing the value of partnership with Iraq. They only talk about Iraq when there is a crisis with Iran, while we have our own interest. And we have half of the country, the West and the North, which is the Kurds and the Sunnis, they want to have a peaceful relationship with the U.S. And also the moderate Southern MPs, the Shia MPs, they also want to have a peaceful relationship with the United States, but without using Iraq against Iran. This is something we cannot accept, and Iraq cannot really tolerate that.
Meanwhile, I'm wondering what all of this will mean for the grassroots protesters in Baghdad who've been demonstrating since October. They were very upset, as you know, with corruption in Iraq. But what are their feelings about Iranian influence in Iraq?
Well, they are already starting a campaign saying the parliament does not represent me, which means the decision yesterday by forceful expulsion of the U.S. forces does not represent their will. They know that when U.S. is withdrawn, when U.S.-Iraqi ties cut, that will means more militias. And that means all of the gains they had, the reforms, is going to be over. And there will be no space for peaceful assembly. That's really very sad. And I am in communication with them on a daily basis. They are urging us to take action, to do something, to save the relationship with the United States for the sake of Iraq. But that's really very helpless, because very few MPs in the Iraqi parliament, they have the courage to publicly say that, to publicly say that we need to save the relationship with the United States, but we also need to start doing a successful negotiation with the United States, how to avoid confronting Iran on the Iraqi soil.
Sarkat Shams, a member of Iraq's parliament, he's been speaking with us from Sulaymaniyya in Iraqi Kurdistan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's red carpet season. Last night, the Golden Globes leading off a parade of upcoming entertainment awards. The Globes are sponsored by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, so maybe it's not too surprising that the festivities nodded to the world beyond Beverly Hills. Right out of the gate, in fact, with host Ricky Gervais pointing a finger in his opening monologue at one big company funneling money into the movie business.
Apple roared into the TV game with a morning show, a superb drama, yeah. A superb drama about the importance of dignity and doing the right thing, made by a company that runs sweatshops in China.
But just in case anyone in the crowd was laughing too hard, Gervais put them in their place too.
The companies you work for, I mean, unbelievable. Apple, Amazon, Disney. If ISIS started a streaming service, you'd call your agent, wouldn't you? So if you do win an award tonight, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech, right? You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg.
The rest, well, it had to be bleeped by NBC. One big winner of the night was South Korean filmmaker Bong Joon-ho. He directed the disturbing family drama Parasite, which won Best Foreign Language Film. With a translator by his side, Bong said audiences miss out on amazing films because of those words at the bottom of the screen.
Once you overcome the one-inch tall barrier of subtitles, you will be introduced to so many more amazing films.
Really? Expand your world. Read subtitles. The devastating bushfires in Australia are exacting a heavy human toll. At least 24 people have died since September. Wild animals have fared much, much worse. Some 500 million have been injured or killed in the fires. That estimate comes from Chris Dickman, a professor of ecology at the University of Sydney. When we reached him today, he had this update.
The 480 million estimate was made a couple of weeks ago, and the fires have now burnt over a large area of further country. That means over 800 million mammals, birds and reptiles have been affected by the fires. Australia-wide, it's probably over a billion.
Dickman has 40 years of experience working across Australia. He told The World's Patrick Wynn about the conditions that animals there are now facing.
This really is unprecedented, I think. There's nothing quite to compare with the devastation that's going on over such a large area so quickly. It's a monstrous event in terms of geography and numbers of individual animals affected.
Give us a better idea, not to be morbid, but how these creatures are dying. Are we talking about actually being burned to death, smoke inhalation, or starvation? What are the different scenarios here?
Death by flames is the most obvious, and I guess some of the images of koalas bring home what that's like most vividly. At the fire front, firefighters have talked about the shrieks of koalas, just screams of pain as they die. It's just horrendous. For others, perhaps those in tree hollows or perhaps those who haven't been able to go too deeply under the ground, smoke inhalation will be a real problem. For the others, it's probably a slower demise. For the species that go underground and then re-emerge after the fires have gone through, there's really nothing except ash on the surface. So it's very difficult then to find resources.
Australia is known for its just amazing wildlife diversity. So are we looking at the extinction of certain creatures being hastened by this?
Yes, I think we are. We know that Australian biodiversity has been going down over the last several decades, and it's probably fairly well known that Australia's got the world's highest rate of extinction for mammals, and it's events like this that may well hasten the extinction process for a range of other species. So it's a very sad time.
What creatures are you really feeling for right now?
There's something called the greater glider. It's the world's largest gliding mammal. It looks a little bit like Gizmo from one of the Spielberg movies some years ago. It's restricted to the eucalypt forests. It's got a diet that's even more restricted than the koala. They'll be cooked in these fires. The yellow-bellied glider as well. It's another stunningly beautiful marsupial, not very well known. They're again restricted to the eucalypt forests, and they're going to be very susceptible to these fires.
How have human beings helped create the conditions for this crisis?
What we're seeing is the effects of climate change. It's sometimes said too that Australia is the, if you like, the canary in the coal mine, with the effects of climate change being seen here most severely and earliest as well. So we're probably looking at what climate change may look at for many other parts of the world in the first stages in Australia at the moment.
Professor Dickman, your demeanor seems very calm, but do you think it's time for people to freak out? And if so, you know, what should they be doing in response to this?
I think there's a feeling among environmental scientists and ecologists in Australia that we've been frozen out of the debate, certainly out of policymaking, and I think it's now time to bring the scientists back into the tent to look at what is likely to be happening over the next few decades, and to think about how best we can maintain both the human community in good health and as much biodiversity as can be retained under this evolving situation.
That's Chris Dickman, ecologist at the University of Sydney in Australia. He was speaking with The World's Patrick Wynn. Now back to our main story today, Iran and the targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. President Trump has vowed to target Iranian cultural sites, that is, if Iran retaliates. Trump tweeted that the U.S. would hit 52 sites, one for each hostage taken in 1979 in Tehran. And the president said the strikes would be very fast and very hard. There was an instant backlash worldwide because bombing cultural sites could constitute a war crime. Ona Hathaway is a professor of international law at Yale. Would striking cultural sites, in fact, be illegal?
Yes, it's very clearly illegal under a number of international laws. The 1907 Hague Convention prohibits hitting cultural sites, as does the 1954 Hague Convention on Cultural Property, which the U.S. has also ratified.
And in your opinion, why is it important to protect cultural sites?
Well, it's the heritage of all of mankind. These are not just the possession of the countries that they happen to be in, but they're important to all of us. These important cultural sites matter in terms of our defining our own humanity.
So President Trump over the weekend said Iran is, quote, allowed to kill our people and we're not allowed to touch their cultural sites. I mean, he was essentially questioning the very premise of this protection. I'm wondering, though, is there a point to be made that humans are more precious than buildings?
There's no doubt that humans are more precious than buildings, but this is not a case of our making a choice between the two. What he's suggesting is that if they break the rules, then we can break the rules as well. But that's not how international humanitarian law works. These rules are in place to ensure the safety of civilians and of our cultural heritage. And the mere fact that Iran may have acted in violation of international law doesn't mean that we can or should go bombing a set of important cultural sites in Iran.
If the U.S. were to follow through on this threat, what would be the ramifications? Could Trump be tried at The Hague or somewhere else?
It does appear that if he were to carry this out, not only he, but those who participate in the operation would almost certainly be guilty of a war crime. Under U.S. law, in fact, it would be possible to prosecute him and anyone who participates in U.S. court. There could potentially be international war crimes prosecution as well, although where that would take place is a little more difficult because the U.S. is not party to the International Criminal Court.
Would that, in your view, realistically ever happen?
I think that it's not unbelievable to imagine that there could be prosecutions of those in the U.S. government if they knowingly participate and intentionally participate in intentional violations of the Hague Convention. Whether that prosecution would happen at the president, hard to say, but there's no reason that he should be above the law.
If Trump ordered the strike, could the military refuse to carry out the order, knowing that maybe they'd be guilty of war crimes if they followed through?
Puts them in a terrible position. There are two things to be said here. On the one hand, if someone is prosecuted for a war crime, it's not a defense to say I was ordered to do it. On the other hand, to refuse an order also puts someone in a position of potentially being court-martialed. And so it puts individual members of the military in a really terrible position. So I hope we don't get there, but if we do, many are sending the message to members of the U.S. military and those who would play a role in carrying out this attack that if they do so, they are potentially subject to war crimes prosecution and that they should refuse the order, even though that might bring with it some consequences.
Ona Hathaway, professor of international law at Yale University. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
It's a tense time for undocumented immigrants in the U.S., even more tense for parents. There's often no way for them to appoint a guardian for their children if they're detained.
In other states, children have been taken into the custody of the state, and then they will be placed in foster care and in foster homes.
So Rhode Island came up with a solution. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The events in Iraq and Iran have overshadowed another major military incident this weekend. Extremists attacked a U.S. military installation on the Kenya-Somalia border and killed three Americans. The world's Halima Gikandi is following the incident. So extremist forces attacking a U.S. military base. It sounds a lot like what happened in Iraq last week, but this is Kenya. What's going on?
So Iran does not have anything to do with this attack. The attack was by Al-Shabaab, which is an extremist group in Somalia. And the group itself, as well as the U.S. military, has acknowledged that Al-Shabaab was behind this attack. Al-Shabaab has a long history of attacking targets in the area where this Kenya Defense Force base is located. Even last January, they attacked a hotel in Nairobi, killing more than 20 people. So they have a long history of waging attacks in Kenya and Somalia. I spoke with Matt Bearden, who is with the think tank Sahan that focuses on the Horn of Africa. He says Iran is not behind it.
I think it's highly unlikely there was any link between the killing of the Iranian major general and the Shabaab attack in Kenya, primarily because an attack of the kind that Al-Shabaab carried out on Manda Bay would have required significant planning, preparation, even just moving the forces into position, would have predated the American airstrike. So I really don't think these two issues can be linked.
Late today, the U.S. Department of Defense released a statement agreeing that Iran is probably not involved in this attack. However, they did caution that Iran has been trying to increase its influence in the Horn of Africa region.
Do we know why Al-Shabaab attacked this base?
Marco, the U.S. military installation here is called Camp Simba. It's partnered with a Kenyan military base here in Manda Bay. And the U.S. has had this military presence there since about 2004. According to AFRICOM, which is the U.S.'s African Command Force for U.S. military in the region, U.S. forces provide training and counterterrorism to support Kenyan troops from this base. The U.S. also has an Air Force squadron based there. This makes Camp Simba a prime target for Al-Shabaab.
And we knew that this type of surprise attack on established military installations like forward operating bases was a routine tactic of theirs. So I think it's just the choice of Manda Bay being a joint Kenya-U.S. installation and presumably a hard target. This is the surprise.
The U.S. has dramatically increased the number of drone attacks on al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. While the drone strikes have diminished the group's ability to hold wide areas of land in certain parts of Somalia, it clearly hasn't stopped al-Shabaab from waging these deadly attacks both in and outside of Somalia.
So, Halima, how is the U.S. countering this?
Well, that's what's interesting, Marco. The U.S. currently has more than 6,000 personnel serving on the entire continent, but the U.S. has signaled in the past 2 years that it will reduce U.S. troops on the ground despite growing terrorism in both Western Africa and the Sahel region. Even if the U.S. does decrease the number of troops, there is actually no sign that the other infrastructure is winding down. In 2019, the U.S. opened a new Air Force base in Niger. I spoke with Adam Moore, who's a professor at UCLA who researches military contracting Africa.
Yeah. So what you kind of tend to see is the military having two different types of bases outside of Camp Limigné. They have drone facilities, and then they have these facilities that are more for special operations forces, both counterterrorism training with local partners and also then for operations.
The immediate response to the weekend strike that killed three Americans, AFRICOM, which is the U.S. African command in the region, has sent a response force to Manda Bay to help secure that airfield.
Halima Gikandi, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's return to our top story today, the aftermath of the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. The mood between the U.S. and Iran has not been this tense in more than 30 years, and we're seeing some ripple effects on our own borders. Dozens of Iranian and Iranian Americans have been questioned at ports of entry across the U.S. Iranian American John Gazvinian was among them. He directs the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for being with us, John. So I want to talk with you about U.S.-Iran relations because that's kind of your specialty at UPenn. But you had this run-in at JFK Airport yesterday in New York. You tweeted, got taken to the special side room and got asked, among other things, how I feel about the situation with Iran. Can you describe what happened?
Sure. I was coming back from Cairo and I was just asked to go into secondary questioning, which is the first time that's happened to me, actually. Mostly routine questions. It was very friendly, very courteous, and it was fairly quick. It only lasted a few minutes. I was asked how I feel about the situation in Iran, which was a surprising question. I simply told them that I didn't think that question was very relevant. It felt like a bit of a political question. I didn't think it was a big deal, so I just sent what I thought was a very lighthearted tweet afterwards about that. And 24 hours later, I'm up to sort of 13,000 followers. It's just been a bizarre... I mean, I hadn't anticipated that kind of response, to be honest. I feel that at the end of the day, I'm a U.S. citizen. I don't feel like I'm under any kind of particular threat, but I know that there are plenty of people out there who are having much more difficult situations.
I mean, your experience was pretty different from some of the other Iranian and Iranian Americans who were detained up to 10 hours in some border crossings. You responded to one concerned person on Twitter that, again, there was nothing aggressive about the agent's questioning. So while I appreciate the concern, really, I'm fine. No reason why I wouldn't be, you wrote. And yet I see the accounts of some people who were trying to cross from Canada into Washington State. One man was quoted saying that the experience conjured up images of Japanese internment camps. And he said it doesn't seem that far-fetched. How concerned are you by what these detentions across the country this weekend could lead to?
Yes, having heard about some of that, it is a little bit concerning. Yeah, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, some of those people are U.S. citizens as well. So these things do have a way of sometimes getting worse. And of course, that's, I think, in the back of every person's mind who's either Iranian or of Iranian origin in the United States, for sure.
Is it in the back of your mind?
Yes. I think this is the thing that I think people sometimes forget. This isn't new for us. This is always in the back of our heads. For a number of years now, it's been difficult to be Iranian in the United States, or even Iranian-American. Look, during the hostage crisis in 79 to 81, things were very, very difficult for Iranians in the United States, and I could easily see that happening again. I hope that it doesn't, and I try to remain optimistic.
Well, John, let me shift gears here, because you are an expert on the history of U.S.-Iran relations at the Middle East Center there at the University of Pennsylvania. So can you put the events of the last week into context for us? What we've seen the last 4 or 5 days, how does it figure into the last 40 years of fraught relations between the U.S. and Iran?
Yes, I mean, obviously, since the revolution in 1979 and the ensuing hostage crisis, relations between the U.S. and Iran have never been friendly. I mean, they were broken off formally in April of 1980 and have never been restored. But there's been a lengthy, and I think a lot of people like to refer to it as a sort of shadow war for 40 years now, but there have been moments the United States actually made really strenuous efforts to try to improve ties with Iran. Ronald Reagan came on the air and 1986 and televised address to the nation. And one of the things he said, it's always stuck with me, is between Iranian and American basic national interests, there need be no permanent conflict.
We seek no territory or special position in Iran. The Iranian Revolution is a fact of history. But between American and Iranian basic national interests, there need be no permanent conflict.
We haven't heard a lot of American presidents since then talking in those kinds of terms.
What do you think many American listeners are just missing as they think about the current state of the relationship between the U.S. and Iran?
To me, one of the things that always stands out is I think people really misunderstand about Iran is that the Islamic Republic has a very, very long history of calculated, measured, and strategic decision-making, though they are certainly ideological, heavily so. They are not wild-eyed, crazy radicals of the type who don't make decisions in their own interests. They have a very, very strong track record of survival. You don't get to stay in power 40 years with the world's great superpowers against you if you're just kind of a crazy, hot-headed Ayatollah. They're deeply rational actors, even though in a lot of times their rational decision-making is made in an attempt to advance a certain kind of ideological agenda.
John Gazvinian directs the Middle East Center at the University of Pennsylvania. John, glad to hear your brief detention at the airport was not terribly eventful. And thanks for the interview.
Thank you very much.
The Department of Homeland Security has been busy following other directives, including keeping tabs on undocumented immigrants. For those living in the U.S. without proper documents, the threat of deportation has always been real, but has become even more intense under the Trump administration. For parents, there's an additional anxiety, fears about what could happen to their children if mom or dad, or both, are detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, people across the nation are scrambling for answers.
They look like any other family. Maria's showing me photos. There's her son at the beach. She, her husband, and their two kids on vacation in New Hampshire. Riding bikes. And of course, baby pictures. When President Trump took office, Maria's daughter was 6 and her son was 7. People began to talk about Trump's immigration policies. Maria heard about them on the news. A local prison started holding detainees for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Maria began to avoid that whole side of town. We're not using her last name because she and her husband are undocumented. Maria came to the U.S. 20 years ago from El Salvador. Her husband's from Guatemala. They worried about what would happen to their children if they were caught by ICE.
Es algo muy, no sé cómo decirle cómo, algo desesperante de que nos vayan a separar de nuestros hijos. Entonces,
Maria says she felt desperate, even thinking about the possibility of being separated from her children and not knowing what would happen to them. Usually, when a parent's detained or deported by ICE, their kids go into state custody. State welfare officials may place them with other family members, or the kids may go into the foster care system. Maria wanted to make sure her children would be with someone they knew and trusted. So, how does a parent do that? Turns out, a lot of people have been asking that question.
To be honest, we did not have an answer.
Elisa Ortiz is at the Appleseed Network, a nonprofit group that works on social justice issues. They started looking into this in 2017.
We thought at the time that it would be easy. We thought, well, you know what we'll do is we'll just gather the forms. There must be forms, right? We'll pull them together. We'll put them in a folder. We'll make them accessible. And we quickly figured out within a couple months that that was pretty much impossible.
That's because guardianship laws can vary from state to state. Ortiz says during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s and 90s, some states set up policies allowing parents to appoint a guardian for their child, but only in the event of their death.
A lot of states only allow you to do it if you're terminally ill and have a diagnosis that you're going to die within a certain amount of time.
Ortiz says most states don't have laws in place that allow parents to appoint guardians in the event of their detention or deportation. She says there's no way to know the impact that's had. How many children have ended up in the foster care system?
We haven't been able to figure it out because a lot of places don't track it.
Activists, lawyers, and immigrants across the country have been trying to find solutions. In Washington, D.C., they successfully pushed for emergency legislation to allow immigrant parents to appoint guardians for their children. Maryland and New York passed bills to do the same. In Rhode Island,
we knew basically what the scenario was, and we knew we had to invent it because it didn't easily fit within any of the existing guardianship structures in Rhode Island law. So we invented it.
Attorney Jennifer Wood of the Center for Justice in Providence got together with other lawyers to create a 6-page packet of legal documents that's been translated into Spanish and other languages. Parents can fill it out, sign it, and give it to the person they've appointed guardian so they can claim the child. Wood says the parents can have the forms notarized, but it isn't required.
We're a very small state, so we have those relationships, so I just picked up the phone. That's a beautiful thing, and that's not always able to occur elsewhere in larger states or even large metro areas.
Wood speaks at gatherings like this one in the Providence suburb of Central Falls. It's a tiny city that's gone from majority white to majority Latino in one generation. The Learning Community Charter School has become an unofficial resource and community center.
Unfortunately, if there is no plan and no designated person, in other states, children have been taken into the custody of the state, and then they will be placed in foster care and in foster homes.
A volunteer translates in Spanish. Parents balance babies on their laps and take notes. Wood tells them if they complete the guardianship forms, state welfare officials will honor them.
They don't want to pay for your kids. That's a good thing. As long as someone has the documents, they're going to leave the kid alone.
The school keeps copies of all its students' documents. Co-director Sarah Friedman says most are from immigrant families.
We're not just kind of in a standoffish, like, well, good luck with that horrible situation you're going through.
One night they had nearly 50 attorneys here to help parents appoint guardians. Friedman says some parents stay away from these sessions out of fear it'll somehow tip off ICE. The school's administrative manager, Maria Duque, says they've done drills to prepare in case they do see ICE officers around. But the drills make her uneasy.
It doesn't feel good doing that because it could be me. I was undocumented for many years, so I had to walk the same path that they are walking right now, and it's not easy. It's not easy.
Maria, the mother at the beginning of the story, lives here in Central Falls, Rhode Island, and her two children are students at the Learning Community School. She came to one of the information sessions, and she's appointed her brother as her kid's guardian if she and her husband are detained. She knows they can be a handful, though, so she's also appointed a backup guardian, a neighbor who's like family. When Maria told her son and daughter about her preparations, they weren't happy. They begged her to never go away. Maria says she tried to tell them that sometimes things happen that you can't control. They still don't understand, but Maria says she feels better. Amid everything happening, she feels lucky to be in a place where she has help to control at least one thing, the most important thing, the safety of her children. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in Central Falls, Rhode Island.
There's still lots going on outside of Washington in the Middle East. For example, there was dramatic news out of Venezuela this weekend. For the past year, President Nicolas Maduro has been in a political standoff with Juan Guaido, the Speaker of Parliament there. Guaido also last year declared himself the legitimate president of Venezuela. But yesterday, the armed forces surrounded the National Assembly building, the parliament, and blocked Guaido from entering. It was a stunning scene. That is the actual moment when Guaido attempted to scale a fence around the National Assembly yesterday while wearing a well-cut blue suit. He got to the top of the tall, pointed iron gate, but then security men pulled him down. As a result, a Maduro supporter was elected speaker inside parliament, while Guaido was later reelected by members of parliament outside. Really dramatic. Guillermo Zubillaga is head of the Venezuela Working Group at the American Society Council of the Americas. That's a nonprofit aimed at a better understanding of Latin America. I asked him if Juan Guaido was still speaker of the Venezuelan National Assembly or not.
I believe so, Marco. I think that his position was so relevant because he was deemed as the only legitimate, democratically elected representative leader of the institution, which was the National Assembly. And yesterday we have seen a lot of statements from the international community saying that what occurred yesterday was, you know, a sham election, that it was impossible for the majority members of the opposition to get into parliament. So far, I think Russia has been the only international actor that has accepted the results. I haven't seen what China has said, but, you know, the European Union, the United States, of course, and also notably other countries in the region like Argentina and Mexico have denounced the procedures that happened yesterday and have asked for a free and fair election in parliament.
Where do you think the real power lies right now? Because Venezuela has two men claiming to be president, Nicolas Maduro and Juan Guaido, and also two men claiming to be a speaker of the assembly. And one of those is also Juan Guaido. So where's the power?
Well, I mean, there's two aspects of power. One, of course, is the de facto power. So that lies a lot in the executive branch, in the military. I mean, we saw the military yesterday physically impeding the members of parliament from going inside the parliament. So that's power right there. However, there's the other side of power, which is legitimacy, international legitimacy, and that also seems to be increasing on Guaido's side. So I know it's kind of like a mixed answer, but I think that Guaido has not been terminally defeated, and he may be weakening the fact that he does not have the actual building to preside over, but I think that he's, you know, his recognition as the head of the National Assembly stays intact. And in fact, he gained some more support than he had.
There are a couple of surprising things for those of us outside Venezuela. For one, Juan Guaido has not yet been arrested. How surprising is that to you?
I think that's surprising. I mean, I think he is still by far the most popular politician in Venezuela. I think that he represents a big hope. I think he also represents, as I said before, he is the person that is recognized by the broader international community. So I think that's what stops the regime from going after him in a way that could further escalate this crisis. And also, I think that they are concerned, the regime, you know, they're concerned about what could be the reaction of part of the military if Guaido were to be arrested.
The other surprising thing, Guillermo, is how Maduro has survived for a year with the opposition, with a respected leader, Guaido, clamoring for him to leave.
Yeah, I mean, they've used, you know, some of the most totalitarian, repressive forms that we are seeing in the world today. For example, there are members of parliament who are disappear in hands of the state. There are members of parliament that have been in jail, tortured without a trial. There are many, many members of parliament who are in exile. And that's not to say about the other offenses. So I think, I mean, we've seen a very full-on, open repression like the one we saw yesterday, where there's actually military and people stopping the head of Congress from entering the building. I think that, you know, that's a new low for a government that was already seen as a dictatorship. So, I mean, there is that. And then the other part is, of course, you know, the role of the international backers that this regime has, predominantly Russia and, of course, Cuba and to a lesser degree, China. So it seems to me that Russia is not backing down their support for the Maduro regime. And that has been instrumental for him to stay in power.
Guillermo Zubillaga, head of the Venezuela Working Group at the America Society, Council of the Americas. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. Appreciate it.
That could be the sound of a courtroom door shutting over the latest case of music plagiarism. Every so often, these fights happen. George Harrison and his tune My Sweet Lord, which he was found to have subconsciously plagiarized from the Edwin Hawkins Singers. That's what emerged in court. Or Katy Perry's hit Dark Horse, which a jury found to be a ripoff of a Christian rap tune. Perry had to pay nearly $3 million in damages. Friday, Miley Cyrus and Jamaican dancehall star Flurgon were in court over this. That line right there in Miley's We Can't Stop. We run things, things don't run we. Okay, here's Flurgon's track, We Run Things. That line is composed of almost exactly the same words. Flurgon sings, things no run we. Miley Cyrus sings, things don't run we. Otherwise, the American and Jamaican songs are different. It happens. There are all kinds of songs in the musical universe that share snippets of identical lyrics, and it never becomes a legal problem. Express Yourself, one by Madonna, another different song by Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. Same titles even, coming back to the same words. Express Yourself, never went to court. In the Miley Cyrus Flurgon case, the Jamaican artist, whose real name is Michael May, felt slighted and sued Cyrus and her company Sony for $300 million for copyright infringement. The parties aren't commenting, but I'm guessing a cultural line got crossed when Cyrus used the pronoun we instead of us. That's a common construction in Jamaican patois where us or our gets substituted by we, as in come over to we house. Anyway, on Friday, the lawsuit ended with an undisclosed payout. There is one other difference between Miley's and Florgan's songs. Florgan's We Run Things went to number one in Jamaica. We Can't Stop made it to number two in the States, and you have to think it could have gone on to number one, but was stopped by, wait for it, Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, later to show up in court for too closely resembling Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, and because we don't stop, we'll be right back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.